Good morning. I call to order this remote meeting of the House Commerce Committee and ask Mr. Dockendorf to take the roll.
Chair Stevenson.
Present.
Vice Chair Cotiza Watoon.
Present.
Representative O'Driscoll.
O'Driscoll present.
Representative Barr.
Here.
Representative Carlson. Representative Carlson. Representative Davney. Representative Davney. Representative Elkins. Representative Elkins. Representative Haley. Representative Haley.
Haley.
Oh, thank you. Representative Cagle.
Present.
Representative Lee.
Lee present.
Representative Lilly. Representative Lislegard. Representative Lucero.
Lucero here.
Representative Olson. Representative Farr.
Farr here.
Representative Rasmussen.
Rasmussen present.
Representative Richardson is excused, and Representative Tice.
Tice present.
And Carlson present.
Oh, thank you.
We have a quorum. Our first item of business is approval of our minutes from April 6, 2022. Vice Chair Cotiza Watoon, do you have a motion?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yes, I would move approval of those minutes.
Vice Chair Cotiza Watoon moves approval of the minutes from April 6, 2022. Any discussion to that motion? Seeing none, all in favor say aye.
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 Opposed? The motion carries, and the minutes for April 6, 2022 are approved. Members, we are taking an informational look at three bills today. There will be no voting on any of these bills, but we will give a good discussion to three issues that I think are worthy of our time. The first bill on the agenda is House File 823 from our own Representative Cagle. Representative Cagle, to your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. House File 823 is a bill that would create a work group of financial institutions stakeholders to discuss the mergers of financial institutions and their tax status. Mr. Chair, since this is an informational hearing, I can't technically move the A1 amendment, but I'd like to point out that this amendment would add an additional seat to the work group to ensure that credit unions and banks have the same number of seats and would change the years in the bill since it was introduced last year. Sorry, let me turn my phone off. This was an idea that was brought to me by the Independent Community Bankers of Minnesota, whose members had voiced concerns to me about credit unions potentially buying community banks, as that trend is increasing nationwide, and a few acquisitions have been attempted in Minnesota. I think the working group would provide an avenue to have some important questions on what happens when a credit union acquires a bank, their various tax designations, and how this creates disparities in mergers and acquisitions, and what happens to state revenue collections if this occurs at a larger scale and how it affects access to these products. So this is just a working group. This work group wouldn't be coming with any predetermined outcomes, but would give policymakers the information to make informed decisions and get insight on the industry trends. And so with that, I will turn it over to my testifiers. First up is Jim Amundson. That's a tough one for me, I guess.
Amundson. Jim Amundson from the Independent Community Bankers of Minnesota. Mr. Amundson.
Thank you.
Good morning. Thank you, Chair Stevenson and committee. And thank you, Representative Cagle. And no worries, my name has been butchered in far worse ways. So thank you for the chance to be with you this morning and offer comments and favor of House File 823. I hope that between my comments and the comments of my colleagues that we will help answer the question that many of you might have, and that's why do we think you should care about this issue? As Representative Cagle indicated, this bill does not mandate anything. It doesn't change anything. It doesn't prohibit anything. It is simply a work group to study what we believe is an important issue and identify key facts around these particular transactions and understand them before we get too far down the road. The one part of the group that I will touch on is the revenue implication. Many of you know, and in case you don't, credit unions are tax-exempt organizations and they do not pay income taxes. So it stands to reason that if these transactions accelerate in number and size, that whatever that cost is today of that tax exemption, it stands to reason that that would grow over time if tax-paying community banks are eliminated or acquired by tax-exempt credit unions. I would also briefly touch on existing statute. There is an existing statute on the books, 49.33. It was a part of, or it impacted a recent transaction, I guess, or a transaction that is in process between a Minnesota community bank and a Wisconsin credit union. It's going to impact that transaction, or it has impacted that, but it's really going to impact how it happens and not impact whether these sorts of things happen in the future, at least is my belief. And as the representative indicated, the work group composition, we are more than happy to have a change to the, would support certainly two credit union representatives in the work group. So with that, I will thank you for the opportunity to testify, and I'm certainly available for questions if there are any.
Thank you, Mr. Amundson. The next testifier is Bernie Gaitko of First National Bank of Waseca. Mr. Gaitko.
Good morning. I'd like to start by thanking the committee also and Chair Stevenson for giving me the opportunity to testify on the issue that is so important to us community bankers. As Representative Stevenson said, I'm Bernie Gaitko, President and CEO of First National Bank of Waseca with branches in Ellendale and Hope. We are a family-owned and operated bank that has been serving our communities since 1874, and today I speak in favor of the bill. Community banks are really just small businesses that serve our friends and neighbors, with typically over 85 to 90% of the deposits we collect going back to our communities and loans. We keep small businesses, farmers, and our communities thriving. First, because it's the right thing to do, but also because we are subject to CRA, Community Reinvestment Act. CRA was enacted in 1977 to encourage banks to help meet the needs of all segments of their communities, including low to moderate income neighborhoods and individuals. The CRA extended and clarified the longstanding expectation that banks will serve the needs of their communities. Today, CRA requires regulators to assess the record of each bank in fulfilling its obligation to the community and to consider that record in evaluating and approving applications for charters, bank mergers, acquisitions, and branch openings. CRA has encouraged banks to open new branches, provide expanded services, and make a variety of community development loans and investments. In addition, CRA has encouraged banks to provide substantial commitments to state and local governments and community development organizations to increase lending to underserved segments of the local economies and populations. CRA applies to FDIC-insured institutions. However, CRA does not apply to credit unions. Fewer financial institutions subject to CRA is an anticipated outcome of the growing number of credit unions and decreasing the number of banks. We believe this should be examined in an attempt to define the possible impact on low to moderate income communities, such as community banks or communities that our banks serve. Thank you again for your time this morning.
Thank you. Our next testifier is Anita Drentlaw. Ms. Drentlaw.
Good morning, Chair Stevenson and the rest of the committee. I'll reiterate our appreciation for the opportunity to testify on this House file. Again, my name is Anita Drentlaw, and I'm with New Market Bank. I'm the president and CEO of the bank, and we serve the Southwest metro communities of Elko, New Market, Lakeville, and Prior Lake. We're a small community bank with asset size of about $190 million, and we have about 40 people as part of our team. Community banks are leaders in small business lending and lending to family farms. We should set public policy, which encourages more community banks rather than less. According to data provided by the SBA, despite holding only 20% of total banking assets nationally, Community banks provide approximately 60% of all small business loans and almost 80% of agricultural loans. This leadership of community banks was made even more clear over the last few years during the pandemic as we swiftly responded to the Paycheck Protection Program, or often referred to as the PPP program. Out of the 184,000 PPP loans made in Minnesota, community banks made approximately 76% of these, which equated to 145,000 loans, compared to mega banks, which made approximately 11%, and credit unions at 6%. In terms of dollars, community banks originated over 80% of the dollars distributed, which assisted in saving an estimated 1.4 million jobs. At our small bank here, New Market Bank, we made almost 552 PPP loans, which equated to over $37 million. This was about half, almost 50% growth within our loan portfolio in two short years. Almost half of those were made to actual non-customers of the bank, which we didn't have a relationship prior to that PPP program. If credit unions and community bank mergers continue to grow in number and size, the outcome on our communities is apparent. We believe we need to look closely at the impact fewer community banks have on small business in terms of lending and the family farms. Thank you again for the opportunity to testify today, and I'd be also happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Our next testifier is Mara Humphrey from the Credit Union Network. Ms. Humphrey.
Mr. Chair and members, good morning. My name is Mara Humphrey. I'm the Chief Advocacy and Engagement Officer for the Minnesota Credit Union Network. Minnesota Credit Union Network represents the state's 93 credit unions with over 2 million member owners and over 400 locations in Minnesota. Credit unions have served as cooperative, locally controlled, not-for-profit financial institutions in Minnesota since the 1920s, and really appreciate the opportunity to come and testify today in opposition to House File 823, which we believe is a solution in search for a problem, and want to just dispel the notion that these transactions warrant a legislative study. I know the initial bill language with two bank representatives and only one credit union representative seemed to be looking to us for a prescribed outcome. Even with a representative study group, the bill requests that this study group really looks into these transactions between banks and credit unions. And I can save you a little bit of time. Out of the nearly 200 Minnesota bank and credit union sales or mergers in the past decade, there have been two of these. Nationally, bank sales to credit unions represent only 0.4% of bank assets sold over the past 10 years. The bill also really focuses on studying tax-exempt financial institutions. And just want to remind the committee that Minnesota credit unions do pay taxes. We're exempt from state and federal income taxes because of their structure as a not-for-profit financial cooperative. But in the end, Minnesota credit unions provide $196 million in direct benefits to 2 million Minnesotans. So as we looked at this bill language for the study, I think really a couple of questions came to mind. Why focus only on this type of acquisition and other tax ramifications and lost revenue to the Minnesota Department of Commerce when a Minnesota bank is purchased by an out-of-state bank? Or what about the ramifications of a bank structured as a sub-S bank acquiring a C corporation? And why only the tax ramifications? Why not impacts to local communities when financial institutions close locations and financial deserts are created? You know, I think we heard a lot of testimony about the community banks and some of the struggles that they seem like they're facing. I think really if we're looking for something to study, large banks in Minnesota have really represented the largest competitive challenge to small financial institutions. Banks in general have consistently controlled over 90% of the deposits here in Minnesota. Out-of-state banks control over 35% of that, and that's a share that has increased over 6 percentage points in the past two decades. Consolidation of financial services really raises the question of potential banking deserts in Minnesota. So in the case that a bank does decide to a credit union, the reality is that these transactions can be win-wins for their community in Minnesota. So just want to take a minute to demystify that. When that situation does happen, customers and employees benefit by retaining access to local, community-focused financial services. Employees keep jobs and communities keep a locally rooted and focused financial institution. Bank shareholders get the best value for their investment, and consumers become member owners in a cooperative financial institution that is structured to serve them. Ultimately, these transactions take place because a bank believes that a credit union is the best purchaser available for its shareholder and for its customers. I'd say really the reason why these purchases do not happen more often or these transactions is because of the regulatory and business model challenges that exist in the marketplace. Now, if the banking industry does not want credit unions buying banks, I think it's up to them. They have the choice to not choose to sell them to a credit union. Mr. Chair and members, I really appreciate your time today to hear our concerns on why we feel House File 823 is unnecessary. With me, I also have Michael Bell, who's the chair of the Financial Institutions Practice Group at Hyman LLP. He's worked across the country on some of these transactions and can give some additional context. We've also had some letters submitted to the committee for the record from our members. So with that, appreciate your time. I'd be happy to take any questions, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Our last testifier is Michael Bell. Mr. Bell.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. As Mara said, I'm an attorney with the law firm of Honigman. I'm licensed to practice in many states, including Minnesota, Wisconsin, and Iowa. This is not about me, but I will add that I spend my time working on these transactions, credit union and bank acquisitions, and I'll leave it at that. I do want to emphasize that, as Mara stated, these are the minority of all transactions in Minnesota, in Wisconsin, Illinois, Iowa, and for that matter, nationally. This has only occurred approximately 45 to 48 times in our entire country, twice or three times in Minnesota, depending on how you count it. So we're talking about a very small amount of transactions. I think the important thing to point out here is today in Minnesota, and in about 18 other states in the country, this has not happened in every state, but 18 states that have weighed in on this, the free market is alive. So banks can choose to include credit unions or consider to sell to a credit union. They're not forced. It's impossible for a hostile takeover to occur. It's simply a choice by a bank. And credit unions can choose if they're interested in trying to acquire the assets of a bank. As soon as states like Mississippi or a couple others start meddling in this and trying to prevent these, the free market then is no longer free. And in fact, the way this is largely done is banks' rights are taken away. In fact, in every state in the country where this cannot occur, which is about three, the regulator has taken away, or the legislature has taken away, community bank rights to sell to a credit union, which strikes me as interesting. Community banks don't have to, but in those states, they can't even consider it. Their rights are limited. So I would suggest that the last thing community banks in Minnesota or anywhere would want to, would be to have their rights to consider taken away, or free market rights taken away. I will also add that if this gets tinkered with, the market, as you know from other examples, unintended consequences occur. So there will be less state chartered institutions, whether it's banks or credit unions. States that do have the free market, their institutions will come into your state. And this has happened, and this is something I testified about in front of the Senate in South Carolina and in front of a Senate committee in Iowa, where there are some questions about these transactions. And they're now seeing the unintended consequences of out-of-state institutions growing stronger at the expense of their in-state or their headquartered institutions. So I simply offer a comment, again, based on the fact that I'm, you know, do this work in Minnesota, in Wisconsin, in Illinois, in your border states, that number one, we can't forget this is a sharp minority of transactions. Number two, if this is a tax question, perhaps it belongs in a tax committee or in a different part of the legislature that weighs in on tax. There's always a tax argument between banks and credit unions, and We should include S-Corp banks there too. That's appropriate in a different form, not for a study bill of this nature. And I appreciate your consideration of allowing the free market to remain free and giving banks the right to choose and credit unions the right to choose regarding these combinations and if they're in the best interest of the communities, employees, owners, and members. Happy to answer any questions anybody may have.
Thank you. We'll now move to member questions and discussions. I can budget about 5 minutes here before we should really move on to the next bill. Representative Lucero.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My question is for Mr. Bell. He referenced that there are three states this is presently not permitted. Which are those three states?
Yes, so I'm happy to answer. And there are some technicalities here. Let me be clear. This is certainly prohibited in the state of Colorado. That was a transaction of a few years ago. There's some existing legislation in Colorado that remains unchanged that prohibits this. It is prohibited in South Carolina. Again, based on some existing legislation, for what it's worth, I believe that legislation will be changed in the near future and that state will become permissible. There's a question in the state of Iowa. A transaction has occurred in Iowa after the fact. An issue was raised by the regulator. I will tell you from my seat, I think there's a question in the state of Iowa. And then most recently, if you read the trade press, the state of Mississippi passed a law taking away their own bank's rights to sell to an institution that doesn't have FDIC insurance. And I would answer the converse, if you don't mind. This is occurring, again, a minority of times, but in Wisconsin and Illinois and Michigan, Florida, all over the country, but in some states that border yours, certainly, or in the upper Midwest.
Representative Lucero, any follow-up?
That's all I have. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. Bell.
Thank you. I see no other members seeking recognition. Representative Cagle, any closing comments?
Thanks for hearing the bill.
Thank you for bringing the bill, and thank you to all the testifiers for the excellent and informative discussion on this issue that I think is increasingly important in our state. The next bill on our agenda for today is House File 4455 from our own Representative Carlson. Representative Carlson, to your bill.
Okay, good morning, everybody. Thank you, Chair Stevenson. Give me just a second here. I'm multitasking, get my notes up. Okay, here we go. House File 44, I'd like to move House File 4455 before the committee.
We're only going to do informational, so no motion necessary this morning, Representative Carlson.
Yeah, I'm just so pre-programmed into that approach.
Okay, I think you're just advocating. You were trying to get it moving. You're advocating.
Well,
never hurts the bill.
Never hurts to try. All right. Well, good morning, everybody. House File 4455 highlights a serious gap in consumer protection regarding broadband. With other essential industries such as electricity and natural gas, we have basic standards to ensure network resilience, reliability, and consumer protections. We need to have a serious conversation about how to restore some balance in broadband and IP-enabled telecommunication systems. We as legislators need to recalibrate how to protect consumers in the telecommunications arena while ensuring we are keeping up with technology and not stifling innovation and consumer choice. Even when there is a competitive balance, the marketplace is not a sufficient regulator to protect consumers from unfair terms and conditions of service and inadequate quality or lack of reliable service. House File 4455 is the middle ground approach necessary to address the problem. Today, we'll hear more specifics from testifiers about the problems consumers face and the basic standards of consumer protections that need to be restored. House File 4455 starts this conversation. I look forward to collaborating with all stakeholders to make sure we can continue to support competition and innovation while establishing reasonable baselines for quality standards and consumer treatment to ensure a robust and fair telecommunications marketplace in Minnesota. So with that, Mr. Chair, I believe we've got a couple of testifiers signed up to present today.
Yes, the first testifier is Human Hidayati from the Communication Workers. Mr. Hidayati.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Carlson. I'm going to see if I can quickly do a screen share of a PowerPoint. Let's see if it works. It's good. Okay. So my name is Fuman Hidayati. I work at Communications Workers of America, CWA, which represents over 1,700 technicians and customer service representatives working for telecommunications providers in Minnesota. And we're in support of this bill and its intent because we think this takes a important step for ensuring reliability of service for customers in Minnesota. Unfortunately, despite industry arguments, competition has not worked to ensure reliable, universal, and affordable service. Nationwide, 28 million households are not subscribed to broadband, 44 million not at FCC's definition of broadband. And in Minnesota, more specifically, about 260 households, or about 20%, 12% of the state, lack home internet, according to census data. And broadband access and adoption in Minnesota is stratified by class and race. CWA's investigations has found that ISPs upgrade infrastructure where it's most profitable and discriminate against lower income customers. So I'm making all this, sharing all these statistics to make the point that after decades of deregulation at state and federal level, customers are left behind and unprotected. And that means that ISPs have very little accountability to their subscribers and stakeholders, and at many times can abandon customers without recourse. And I'm sure many of you have heard some horror stories from your constituents. Voice service via broadband, voice over IP, has largely replaced plain old telephone service, or a POTS as we call it. And as you see in the chart here, over the last 20 years, internet broadband use has increased from less than 20% to over 28%. Around 80%. So this means that broadband is a mature, dominant communication service that deserves state oversight. Traditionally, states exercise extensive oversight of their copper-wired POTS services. Minnesota still does this to some degree. And this includes requirements to comply with service quality and consumer protection standards, including requirements for universal service on backup battery requirements. So enduring weather emergencies, fires, and power outages, you can still call 911. If your phone service goes down, your POTS provider is supposed to get it up and running within 24 hours. And those that rely for their phones during emergency can rely on service not getting disconnected when the power goes out, or during pandemic, they can continue with social contact remotely, particularly the elderly and those in rural areas. So unfortunately, as the technology changed into broadband, dominated by broadband, this POTS regulation did not evolve with the advent of broadband. And this has created a major disparity in telecom regulation. So I think this bill makes some great steps in starting the conversation on some basic standards. It ensures that ISPs are adequately maintaining and equitably investing in the communities and in their network infrastructure. It provides for resiliency so that providers are required to provide information on outages, on public safety issue. It provides a venue for providers' emergency preparedness plans and post-emergency restoration to be shared, to set backup power standards for broadband and ensure customers have reliable connections and service, and also provides for data collection so that customers and can have access to what services they're getting, and the state agencies can analyze this data and share them publicly. Of course, the federal government has an important role to play in funding deployment, and as they're be sharing hundreds of millions of dollars with Minnesota for deployment. Federal government also manages the spectrum, sets the floor on public interest protections, but there are many areas though that relate directly to infrastructure in Minnesota and its impact on Minnesota residents. So with that said, I'd like to, if possible, hand this over to our Minnesota staff rep, Jeff Latcher, to just briefly talk about the, what he's hearing from our technicians on the ground. And thank you. And I'll stop the screen share.
Thank you, Mr. Hadayati. We do have Mr. Latcher here. Mr. Latcher.
Thank you. Yes, my name is Jeff Latcher. I'm a staff rep for CWA, and I thank you for the opportunity to speak. The communications industry has changed as fast as the technology that powers it. And with the advent of fiber, more customers get their telecommunications through broadband and VoIP than copper. This is not only to be celebrated, but it must be accelerated. Over fiber, data moves at the speed of light. Unfortunately, fiber deployment does not. In the meantime, despite all the benefits of these new technologies, there are some good reasons why people don't all switch off of POTS, again, plain old telephone service, at least not voluntarily. And this is where the industry and the public's interests diverge. State law provides protection to consumers with POTS. No such provisions apply to the growing majority of people who do not have POTS. This exposes some immediate problems. According to many of the CWA techs I've spoken to, companies who provide POTS are actively discouraging customers from retaining that service, sometimes by telling them it's no longer available in your area. That's a direct quote, by the way. The purpose of moving customers out of POTS is not just to reap higher profits from the more expensive services, but it's also to relieve the company of any accountability. Once grandma gives up POTS, she gives up her right to have timely repairs. She gives up assured access to 911 when the power goes out, and she gives up being able to call customer service when she has issues. If the VoIP line she switched to goes down, the company can delay the repair, prioritize more valuable customers, or favor signing up new customers over maintaining the service for those already paying. The fact is, the two largest telecom companies subject to Minnesota service quality standards regularly fail to meet them. Thankfully, the PUC is empowered to hold them accountable for such things, and this sheriff is kept quite busy. They'll tell you, I'm talking about the telecom providers, they'll tell you that competition will force them to maintain quality service. Yet a very large telecom provider in Minnesota, who shall remain unnamed, recently argued at a PUC proceeding that they could not meet the POTS service standards precisely because of the competition. In the last 4 years, including the entire pandemic period, when the absolute necessity of broadband access was so painfully exposed, this company reduced its workforce by 52% in Minnesota, arguing with each reduction that it was due to competitive pressures. This workforce provides service for both POTS and broadband. So competition and drastic staff reductions means the companies focus more on new installations and gaining new customers. They wondered out loud how they could be expected to maintain service and keep up with repairs for their existing customers. In the wild west of broadband, the sheriff is barred from protecting the consumer. Despite the millions, check that, billions of dollars being poured into broadband build out around the country, there is almost no talk about accountability. This bill starts the conversation. It provides the PUC with the ability to monitor service quality provided by broadband providers and to develop appropriate standards to ensure that both the taxpayer and the consumers get what they're paying for. Of course, we'd all prefer to be able to trust the big corporations who provide broadband in Minnesota, but with so many public dollars at stake and with so much of our kids' education, our healthcare, and our economy depending on fast, reliable internet, how can we shy away from any responsibility to, at the very least, let the sheriff, I mean the PUC, monitor what's going on? Thank you.
Thank you. We'll now move to member discussion and questions. Representative Lucero.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I have a couple questions for the bill author. The first question is, which mediums are in scope within the bill?
Representative Carlson.
Representative Lucero, can you expand on that a little bit?
Representative Lucero.
Sure. Broadband is the only term I've heard in discussion today. Broadband is a generic term that encompasses multiple mediums. I did hear POTS, which is plain old telephone service, but there is also fiber, there is coax, there is cellular that all provide quote unquote broadband. So which mediums are you referring to in your bill?
Representative Carlson.
Yes, thank you, Chair Stevenson and Representative Lucero. I'm gonna defer to one of my testifiers. In my conversations up to this point, the conversation has been strictly with regards to broadband. I'm going to take a quick look at the bill and defer to my testifiers at this time.
And I do see that in the bill, it does define broadband as already defined in section 116J.39. And broadband there is any service providing advanced communications capability and internet access with transmission speeds at a minimum that meet the Federal Communication Commission's definition for broadband. I don't know if Mr. Hidayati or Mr. Lacker wanted to add any more to that.
Yeah, just very thank you. Very briefly, I think broadband would include fiber. It would include any kind of IP enabled services that customers are getting their internet service at home. Anything that comes through cable. So that would be DSL, that would be fiber, that would be cable broadband. With wireless, those are a little regulated differently, and the FCC plays a larger role in regulating wireless. So that's, I think, not included in the conversation here. And with VoIP, voice over service, that's a service that's provided through broadband. So that would also be included in here.
We can do about 5 more minutes on this bill. I just want to be respectful of members. We have had 2 long floor sessions the last 2 days, and I'm expecting another one today, tomorrow, and the next day. So, Representative O'Driscoll.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. Chair.
Sorry, Representative Lucero. I'm sorry. Your hand went down, and so I forgot that I needed to go back to you. My apologies. Representative Lucero.
Sure, thank you. And is there, how many more have their hands up? I don't want to monopolize the entire
two additional members.
Okay, then I'll just ask one more question. Thank you, Mr. Chair. So then in regards to, the purpose for my first question, was because, broadband takes many forms, multiple mediums, and just so members are aware that we'd be roping in multiple different mediums, which would have unintended consequences. Number two, in the opening remarks of the bill author, we heard a comparison to other industries like natural gas, other utilities, natural gas, and other services. And there's a huge difference here. Because when it comes to those who use natural gas as a utility, for example, there is only one infrastructure, one pipe that gets pulled to the house. It's not feasible to have competitors having multiple pipes through the street, through the front lawn to the house to attach in order to provide a competitive service. That is, it's not a good comparison now when you're talking about internet, because you do have multiple mediums that are hitting the house, whether it be cellular, whether it be coax, which is cable, whether it be DSL, which would be over POTS lines, the telephone provider, or whether it be fiber, which would be, it could be possibly none of the above. And so there are multiple options for competitors. So it's not a good comparison whatsoever. Another thing I heard earlier in the commentary was everything, the discussion is on broadband, but then all the complaints I heard from the testifiers was in regards to telephone service. Well, telephone service is just one of the many services that provide that are run over broadband. You have streaming of television programs. You have a multitude of services that run over this. And so if the complaint is in regards to a telephone service or 911 access or outages due to lack of battery backup, et cetera, it is way overkill to take the entire medium, put it under the PUC. The PUC would have no interest, or should not, I should say, have any interest in regulating other services that would ride on top of broadband, like streaming service, Netflix, et cetera. Then the last thing I heard, and I'll finish up with this, is that there's some kind of a disparity for lower income. Completely false, absolutely false. Out in my community, I have large parts of rural Wright County that do not have broadband access at all, except for cellular, possibly. But then in the city of Minneapolis, for example, the entire city of Minneapolis, whether it be through fiber or through wireless internet, through U.S. internet, a company I used to work for, has access to broadband, the entirety of Minneapolis and beyond. So to manufacture a false idea of lack of access to lower income is something we just need to know the truth. And that is a completely false statement. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Rasmussen.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Carlson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just a quick response to Representative Lucero. His lived experience is one thing, but to call the testimony before us today as false is just unfair and inappropriate. To the point made about my comparison between broadband and other utilities is that this is an essential service, was the point that I was making, and that this ensures network resilience, reliability, and consumer protections. I'm not talking about the mechanics of it all. I'm talking about those key functions of what do cause for the comparison to which I made. I will let the other, I'm not going to get into the comments made on the other testifiers' testimony, but you know, they're speaking from their experiences, and to call those false is you know, I think inappropriate in terms of the debate to which we are trying to have here today in setting a baseline of discussions on, quite frankly, an industry that is unregulated at this point and needs some sense of consumer protections at the forefront as we continue to spend millions, if not billions of dollars of taxpayer dollars to expand this infrastructure.
Thank you, Representative Carlson. Representative O'Driscoll.
Mr. Chair, maybe I will just make these as comments given the time that we have and the length of other questioners on here, and I'll make them rhetorical in nature. I don't know that we've checked in with the Minnesota Office of Broadband to get their feedback on this. They were created by the legislature for the purpose of providing broadband, and if there's anything that needs to be done, perhaps we can have conversations with those folks before we put in the PUC. The reason I say that the PUC, I have a little bit of a question on that because they regulate a lot of other utility industries in the state of Minnesota. There may be some unintended consequences to the marketplace as we're trying to move this under the PUC's jurisdiction. What are some of those unintended consequences? There are a number of other technologies that are moving beyond broadband. And we've had a number of members in the legislature for as long as I've been who have said, no more money to broadband. Because of these other technologies. And so are we in maybe a last phase in trying to regulate this? That's again a more global question. And then finally, I believe that Mr. Lacker's comments were national statistics that he was sharing with us and not Minnesota specific. And so again, we're getting an idea nationally, but we don't know for sure how our Minnesota providers are doing based on his individual testimony from what I gleaned here. So, Mr. Chair, thank you. Those are my comments.
Thank you, Representative Driscoll. Representative Rasmussen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll keep my comments brief. I just wanted to say, you know, broadband is a really important issue in the area that I represent because a lot of folks, you know, don't yet have access to high quality, high speed internet. However, I think it's important for this committee to recognize that we are seeing more access to broadband than ever before. Huge investments are being made. We're also seeing higher quality broadband, faster speed, more reliability. And lastly, the internet service provider market has never been more competitive, whether it's more wireless providers, fiber providers. And so I don't see the need for this new added regulatory structure that I believe would just add costs and delays and actually discourage continued investment into expanding broadband services in the communities that I represent. And so just wanted to express those concerns, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Rasmussen. Any closing comments, Representative Carlson?
No, I just want to thank the chair and the committee for hearing this bill today. And again, my offer still stands in terms of stakeholders, others that are interested in continuing to work on this important issue, on this important legislation. We welcome your involvement. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you, Representative Carlson. And I think that I know you're working with any stakeholders who approach, and that's the whole reason to have this public hearing. And I'm sure that's part of the reason why you asked for it, was so that we could tee up the issue for further discussions and communications. It's an important issue, and I'm really glad you're working on it. The last bill on our agenda today is House File 3465 from Representative Long. Representative Long, to your bill.
Thank you so much, Mr. Chair. I appreciate you having me before the committee today. House File 3465, I believe, is a simple but powerful bill. It would require insurance coverage of infertility treatment considered medically necessary by a healthcare provider. I am introducing this bill on behalf of constituents who approached me with their fertility challenges. My constituent wrote, "My wife and I are in the midst of infertility treatments, and even with the best coverage and our decent salaries, we are being denied coverage, and the expense of treatment so that we can begin our family is an overwhelming and disheartening mountain to climb. Currently, my insurer caps our lifetime benefits at $10,000, making any infertility treatments not covered in any way, shape, or form. This requires that one be wealthy in order to start a family. This story is not uncommon. Currently, fertility treatment is limited to those fortunate enough to be able to afford it, or who go into debt or raise money for those expenses. My wife and I are fortunate to have two amazing children, 3 and 5 years old, who are the best things in our lives. I know that fertility challenges are not rare, and they are often private struggles. Approximately 10% of all women have received some assistance for infertility. That's why 17 states, red and blue, from all parts of the country, have passed laws requiring insurers to cover for infertility diagnosis and treatment. This includes states like Arkansas, Louisiana, Montana, Ohio, Texas, West Virginia. This bill would have Minnesota join these states in providing needed medical coverage, and more importantly, in providing hope to so many Minnesota families. And Mr. Chair, I have 3 testifiers I've invited today, Andy and Rachel Wilkie and Mariah Grand, and I'd like to turn it over to them now to share their stories.
Certainly, we can start with Andy and Rachel Wilkie. To the Wilkies.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, thank you for allowing us to testify today in support of requiring infertility treatments like IVF, as outlined in House File 3465. My name is Andy Wilkie. I'm here with my wife, Rachel. We're joining you from Mankato. Our infertility story began after trying to conceive the old-fashioned way. After more than a year and no success, we sought treatment with a doctor who is a fertility specialist. We endured another year of countless tests and treatments. Nothing was successful.
After a major surgery, I was diagnosed with endometriosis, which took a significant toll on my physical health. After that came more tests, treatments, poking and prodding. Infertility is a silent diagnosis. The impact it had on our mental health is immeasurable. It was filled with self-blame, guilt, shame that continues to affect us to this day. We both felt so alone, broken, and hopeless. We had our daughter's name picked out the day we got married. Our dreams of creating her and our future family were slowly slipping away.
We had one last option remaining, IVF. We connected with another doctor specializing in IVF that explained to us that the chance of success was still only a little better than 50%. The other big obstacle was financial. We had already spent thousands of dollars on deductibles and co-pays, but we soon learned that my employer-sponsored insurance plan would not cover IVF. Having already maxed out 2 credit cards, we knew we needed cash to move forward. We ended up taking out a personal loan of $25,000. Infertility is not covered by insurance because it's often seen as a women's issue. However, in the case of infertility, nearly half of all cases are due to male factor infertility. Globally, 1 in 8 couples struggle with infertility. Approximately 12% of American women have difficulty becoming pregnant, making infertility roughly as common as diabetes. Over the course of 40 years, there have been more than 8 million births as a result of IVF. That's 8 million children brought into this world to parents who want so desperately to start a family, they endure immense pain, uncertainty, and financial distress. You as elected officials have a responsibility to define our values as a state and codify them into law. Use that awesome power to give Minnesota families the opportunity to feel the pure joy of parenthood.
Our story is painful and still raw, but unlike so many, it has a happy ending. In 2017, after 3 years of trying, I gave birth to our little girl because of IVF. And again this year, we had our little boy, again because of IVF. Our family feels whole and our hearts are mending through the trauma we all endured. We're grateful for the medical technology available to make our dreams come true. We want more families in Minnesota to get the same chance we had without significant financial burden.
Thank you, Chair Stevenson, for allowing us to share our story today. Too many couples feel ashamed or embarrassed to talk about infertility. We're happy to share our story in an effort to help more Minnesota couples become parents. Thank you, Representative Long, for offering this bill. We urge the committee to support House File 3465.
Well, thank you both for coming today. And I think you hit the nail on the head on the end in particular, which is that this is a story that is often difficult for people to tell. And I really appreciate you being willing to come to the committee and telling it. And I'm certainly glad that your story has, as you put it, a happy ending, and congratulations on that. The next testifier is Mariah Graham. Ms. Graham.
Thank you, Chairman Stevenson and members of the committee. My name is Mariah Graham. I'm a born and raised citizen of the great state of Minnesota, a U of M graduate, an operations analyst, and my husband and I have endured the brutality of infertility for the past 7 years. As a child, if you asked me what I wanted to be when I grew up, my answer was always a mother. In 2015, my husband and I decided to start a family. What followed was a diagnosis of male and female factor infertility, multitudes of tests, 7 invasive infertility treatments, and 6 heart-wrenching miscarriages that came with the unimaginable price of $102,000. We were forced to take out a second mortgage on our home. I have great health insurance, but I was denied coverage for treatment of my infertility, which is a disease as defined by the World Health Organization. The horrific pain of infertility is devastating. Studies have shown that women with infertility can have the same levels of anxiety and depression as women with a cancer diagnosis. To add to the horror, we were crushed financially. In 2019, we looked to adoption, only to discover that path was just as emotionally, mentally, and financially taxing as infertility treatment. So with the encouragement of our family, we went to see a specialist who had a new solution for treating our disease. By this time, we had exhausted all of our means financially. So my sisters organized a fundraiser, and with the love of family and friends, we raised $22,000 for a final round of IVF. Never in my wildest dreams did I imagine needing to throw a bake sale to have a baby. A year and a half later, in February of 2021, Isla Gertrude Graham was born, healthy as can be. 1 in 8 couples suffer from infertility, as you just heard. That equates to 115,000 Minnesotans. We all know someone who is afflicted with this disease. Please give those suffering from infertility the family building opportunities they deserve and pass HF 3465 to bring infertility coverage to Minnesotans who are suffering like me. Thank you for your time and consideration.
Thank you, Ms. Grant. And as I said to the Wilkies, I appreciate the time and courage to come here and share your story. And I'm also grateful for the happy ending. The last testifier who signed up is Laura Beth Elm. Ms. Elm. Ms. Elm, we cannot hear you. You're not muted, but still not getting you. I'm going to suggest that perhaps if you try to log out and log back in, or perhaps from a different device, that might be worthwhile. While we're waiting for that, I'm going to go to the first member, but I will come back to you in between each member that talks to see if we can get you in. But I would suggest that you try and log out and log in, or try a different device, because we're not hearing you currently on the device you're on right now.
Test, can you hear me?
Oh, now we can. Ms.
All Hall. Right. You know, sometimes there's like triple muting, and I think I've got the right microphone going, but I was wrong. So I appreciate your patience. Thank you so much. Chair Stevenson, is it all right if I continue?
Please do.
Okay, thank you. Chair Stevenson and members of the committee, my name is Laura Elm, and I'm here today to oppose HF 3465. I previously worked at a health services company and supported a benefit for IVF coverage. I witnessed the fertility industry from the inside and detected many flaws. The suffering of infertility is real and unfortunately horribly widespread. Access to effective, affordable treatments should be encouraged. However, as this bill is primarily concerned with the coverage of IVF, that is the generation of living human embryos in a lab, it's necessary to look at some of the IVF industry's critical failings. First, the reported IVF success measures omit a critical variable, and that's the number of embryos created. This lack of transparency is a disservice to prospective patients and opens the door for unscrupulous lab practices. Secondly, we don't know how many embryonic human beings are already in frozen storage in labs and warehouses. It could be a million in the United States, or it could be a million just in Minneapolis. This is a known industry problem that mandates like these exacerbate. The third failure is that the informed consent process often fails to cover basic yet critical patient education. Prospective patients have a right to know, for example, what an embryo is, that they can talk with their provider about limiting the number of embryos created, and that there are many reasons why their embryos may die in the lab. And finally, there are almost daily news stories of tragedies concerning patients whose embryos were lost, destroyed, or mixed up and transferred to the wrong family. Before we require insurance plans to cover IVF, we must first recognize the industry's failings, and I hope put reform plans in place to address them. Thank you for letting me share today, and I'm happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Ms. Elm. We'll now move to member discussion. It is 10:11 right now. I am going to adjourn this committee at 10:20 at the latest to give members a chance to get ready for our floor session at 11. Representative Rasmussen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I appreciate all the testifiers sharing their stories here today and having this conversation. Mr. Chair, I just wanted to recommend to the bill author, if he already hasn't, to try to get this submitted for the mandated health benefit review process so we can get some information analysis back, hopefully for next session, on what the cost of this would be for the health insurance plans and for premiums. And I also think it would be helpful to understand what the cost would be. I know the bill before the committee does not apply to state public programs, but I do think it would be helpful to understand what those costs would be if this mandate were extended to insurance products that are subsidized by the state. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Rasmussen. Representative Wong, did you want to speak to that? You unmuted yourself.
I did, yes. Thank you, Representative Rasmussen, for the suggestion. That is my intent to submit it for review this fall.
Well, you know, the way to submit for review is to let the chair of the Commerce Committee know you want it reviewed, and I think you just did. So,
Mr. Chair, would you please consider this for review?
Mr. Brown, would you please submit this file to the Commerce Department for review?
Will do, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. All right, it's been submitted. Representative Katiza Watoon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Long, for bringing this bill forward. It is such an important part of the conversation that we it's really necessary to bring forward, because it is such a painful and often really private suffering that individuals and couples go through. My husband and I suffered from infertility for years, and people may not believe that when they find out that we have four children. Our older three children are adopted out of the foster care system. I will touch a little bit more on fertility, but it would be remiss. I would be remiss to not share, given one of our testifiers mentioned about how expensive and difficult private adoption can be, that the state of Minnesota has a program called the Waiting Child Program. Children who are legally eligible for adoption after their parental rights have been terminated, and the state does help with all the fees involved in that. So for anyone watching today who is open to foster care and adoption, they should definitely check out that path, because it is much more financially accessible. But I have polycystic ovarian syndrome, which led to some difficulty for us to conceive. And we went through a number of intrauterine insemination processes. So we didn't go all the way to IVF. A big part of that reason was financial, but it becomes emotionally taxing as well as financially taxing, and just felt like we were kind of flushing money down the drain. And so I know that some employers have begun to cover different fertility treatments for their employees, which is so wonderful. Different employers have begun to cover some of the costs of adoption, which is also wonderful. I think for people who don't have access to that this is a step in the right direction, and that we can continue having this conversation. And there's so many facets that we need to look at in order to help people create or build the families that they've always dreamed of, and to make sure that every child in Minnesota has a safe and loving family to call home.
Thank you, Representative Katiza Watoon. Representative Tice.
Representative, I just have a thank you, Mr. Chair. I just have a quick comment for Representative Long. What I'm not seeing here is something to support the couples in the counseling mental health realm. I would like to see that as well. In our family, we have a couple who went through years trying to conceive a child. And after they finally got the child, they just, their relationship was so damaged that they ended up not being together. So everybody talks about, and I know we've seen it from everyone, how hard this is to go through, but it would be nice to see some support for them in that way as well. I know a couple of them have mentioned it, but if we're going to do this, I think that we need to do it right and have support for them for all their needs, not just physical. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Tice. Representative Lucero.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I guess at this point, just wanted to echo what most of the previous members have already said. And I want to thank the testifiers for coming forward and sharing their very personal stories. So I got married at 19, and we have been trying to have kids for over 20 years, unsuccessfully. And we've traveled the infertility continuum from the easy stuff all the way up to IVF. So I can tell you from personal experience, and we've done IVF twice, and I've shared this in other committees before, but not in this committee. But endometriosis, yep, very familiar with that. That is the infliction that we have as well. And it is very cost prohibitive. In the States, I think IVF, at least when we last did it, it was about $25,000. It's probably more now. But we had to go internationally in order to save money. So believe it or not, we had to travel to other countries in order to try to save money. And even then, it was still cost prohibitive. And so, yes, this is a very important conversation. There are many that are inflicted with this. And I don't remember who said it, but absolutely, this does create a significant toll on parents that are trying to have children with depression and feelings of regret and all of that. So this is a very sensitive topic. It's a very important topic. And unfortunately, there are way too many that are suffering with this. So thank you for this conversation.
Thank you, Representative Lucero. Representative Tice, your hand's back up. I don't know if you were, oh, and now it's down. Okay. Well, I see no members wishing further recognition. Representative Long, any closing comments?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to thank Andy and Rachel and Mariah for sharing their stories, and Representative Katisa Watun and Representative Lucero as well for sharing theirs. I think these matters are often, as I said, personal, and often we don't recognize how commonplace they are for these diagnoses and other medical conditions that we're trying to solve here. And so I hope that this bill can advance. I appreciate the members' consideration today, and appreciate all of the individuals who took time to tell their personal stories. I know that will matter to moving this process forward.
Thank you, Representative Long, and I want to share in your thanks to the members and the testifiers again for sharing their stories. And I think it is only helpful to hear people talk openly about the struggles that they've had, in hopes that we can try and find better solutions. So thank you to everyone, and thanks to committee members, and we'll see you on the floor in a few minutes. But until then, the committee is adjourned.